The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I want to look at a couple of passages in the Bible in relation to the question of euthanasia. And what I'd like to do is consider the question of euthanasia first as a kind of killing, and secondly as a kind of letting die. Now, we've talked about this before, but we haven't spent much time on actual biblical cases, and I'll be very brief about this. First passage I'd like to look at is Judges 9, 54 to 57. Judges 9, 54 to 57. And here we, let me just read it. We have this is the story of Abimelech, and after his victory, let me start with verse 50. Then Abimelech went to Tebez and encamped against Tebez and took it. But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the people of the city fled to it, all the men and women, and shut themselves in. And they went to the roof of the tower, and Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it, and drew near to the door of the tower and burned it with a fire. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone upon Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called hastily to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, 'A woman killed me.'" And his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his home. Thus God requited the crime of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing 70 brothers. And God also made all the wickedness of the men of Shechem fall back upon their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. Now, here we have, though the author neither approves nor disapproves directly of this mercy killing, the context shows that this is an unethical procedure, trying to make something bad look good. Is always ethically a compromise. And here, the idea that the woman had killed him seems to be a very bad thing. So he wanted to have his armor bearer thrust him through and did. So there are a number of references like this in the Bible to actual mercy killing, and all of them are negative. Let's look briefly at 1 Samuel 31. 1 Samuel 31, 3 to 6. 1 Samuel 31. Let me start with the beginning of the chapter. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab, and Machishua, the son of Saul. The battle pressed hard upon Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and make sport of me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. And, of course, you have a technical term there. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all the men the same day together. And when the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley, and those beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled, that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And here you do have more of an authorial negative pronouncement in saying that the armor bearer wouldn't do it because he feared. And you have two kinds of fear here. You have the fear of men, but you also have the fear of doing something unethical. Now, Matthew 27, verse 5, this will be very familiar. Matthew 27, verse 5, when Judas, this is verse 3, his betrayer, saw that he was condemned, he repented and brought back 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned in betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See to it yourself. And throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, he departed, and he went out and hanged himself. And then, of course, they couldn't take the money and put it in the temple because it was polluted. Obviously, you have a condemnation of suicide. Now, you have here, I think, in this setting, some pretty clear scriptural teaching that killing yourself, whether to avoid shame or suffering, is something illegitimate. And the command against murder would include, in that sense, the murder of self. And John Frame points out in some place in one of his books in his book on medical ethics, that suicide contradicts the legitimate self-love that Scripture assumes and commends. Now, that's been a tricky thing in evangelical circles. Matthew 22:39 says this is the first and great commandment. The second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And a very clear passage on this, very familiar because we often hear it at weddings, is Ephesians 5:28. Ephesians 5:28, and here the injunction is to the husbands that they are to love their wives as their own bodies. And he adds, he who loves his wife loves himself, for no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church. Now, I say that this has been caused some concern in evangelical circles because there is a teaching around that says there are actually three commands. Love God, love your neighbor, and love yourself. And that Christ, in a sense, is implying that when he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then they develop from that we should all nurture self-love of a proper kind and so on. I don't think that's correct. I don't think the Bible tells us that there are three commands, love God, love neighbor, and love self. What I think the second and great commandment is telling us is that the kind of love you should have for your neighbor is the kind of love that you're typically going to have for yourself in moments like self-preservation, or when you have an opportunity, or whatever it might be. This is not some metaphysical principle of self-love. Paul, and when he's talking to the Ephesians here, he's saying to them, the husband should love his wife in a way that amounts to the way you take care of yourself. Now, obviously, he's talking about normal people. You can find exceptions. You can find people who don't love themselves, don't take care of themselves, don't love their own flesh. But he's saying, you know, in a normal circumstances, we get dressed in the morning. If we have a cut, we put a Band-Aid over it. If if we're thirsty, we drink. If we're hungry, we eat. We take care of ourselves. That's a normal thing. And we should take care of others as we take care of ourselves. But I think Frame is right that there is a kind of self-love that is implied and that is commensurate with the dignity of who we are. And I would add to that, And you have to say this carefully, because, you know, if you say it the wrong way, it really can be misunderstood. But I would add to that that the fact that Christ died for us means that there is a dignity about us. We are such that Christ died for us. Now, that's not saying he saw how worthy we were, or that he approved of our humanity or anything like that. That he died for us because we were completely unworthy, as a matter of fact. But when you do consider that he did die for us, then you consider that we have a value. And the Sermon on the Mount tells us of how great value we are. God knows when every hair from our head falls, and how much more value are we than the sparrow, and so on. And this fits in to the ethics of life preservation, so that not only is suicide wrong because it is a kind of self-murder, but it's wrong because it contradicts the self-worth that Scripture says we have as creatures redeemed in Christ. Two more points with a few more scriptural references, and then I want to go right into the living will. The first, and again we've said this a lot, suffering does not make a life worthless. Or putting it another way, the fact of suffering, perhaps even very hard suffering, does not mean that you need to seek to do away with that life because the hardship has become of greater weight than the benefits. You don't, in Scripture, you don't measure life in terms of cost benefits. Romans 8 is, as you know, a wonderful chapter on the problem of suffering for the Christian. And there are many parts of this chapter. One of the key verses, of course, that Paul, where he's considering his own estate, in verse 18, he says, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth compared to the glory that is revealed to us. For the creation waits in eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. The creation is subject to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of him who subjected it, in hope, because the creation itself will be set free from the bondage of decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God." And here you have quite a balance. On the one hand, the world to come is so far better that it's not worth to be compared to our present suffering. On the other hand, we don't take a shortcut to get there, because we are subject to futility and to hope. And hope is a very important part of the present life. And for whatever mysterious reasons there are that God uses to allow suffering, it involves, among other things, the nurturing of hope in the person who's suffering. And it's easy to say this, and of course it's very hard to go through it or to sit by somebody who's going through it. But that is the biblical teaching, that though the glory to come is far greater than to be comparable to the earthly sorrows that we have, yet the earthly sorrows are part of God's will as it instills hope in us. And we can't therefore seek a kind of shortcut, because our present life has value. And then finally, and very closely tied to this, our lives are not our own. We do not belong to ourselves. When Paul addresses the Corinthians on the problem of prostitution in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, among other arguments, he says, "How can you go and frequent a prostitute? This kind of immorality is a sin against your own body." And then in verse 19, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, which you have from God? You are not your own. You were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body." This this present life for the Christian is a precious life bought with a price, and therefore it's not ours to do as we will. Now, if this is true, what about decisions at the end of life? What about decisions about the what they call, a bit glibly, the final exit? Well, let's, with this setting of these scriptural directives, let's look at the living will, and then let's elaborate this a fair amount, and then come back to the scriptural injunction. So let me pass out to you one example of a living will. All right, there are several parts of this, of course. Let's start at the beginning. Living will declaration. All right, to whom is it addressed? All right, family, doctors, and all those concerned with my care. Any comments on the appropriateness of directing this document to these particular people? Well, let me back up. Let me back up before we get to that. What do we think about the general principle of self-determination in matters of the final exit? Where is it proper, and where might it be dangerous to have the patient or the potential patient be the one to make this kind of decision? Absolutely. You're making the decision, so if anything, just to begin with, you are trying to avoid putting that burden on other people. Now, that of course becomes a question of whether it's legal or not, but assuming it is legal, then it, you know, that seems, that I think has a lot to commend it. Any other reasons to think that the person who is going to be the patient would be the appropriate person to make the decision? Obviously, a lot of this depends on the cultural context. We're living in a relatively free country where we have a fair amount of self-determination. Does, you can imagine living in some countries, you don't decide these things, but we do. Well, I mean, who else would decide? Physician or family, and in some societies, I suppose, clergy and so on. I would hate to make a decision that locked me into something that was irreversible, whether or not suddenly my case improved. I think I would, I mean, this living will tries carefully to state it in such a way that it's only in the worst of circumstances, but I, as a patient, do not have the competence to know exactly what's involved all the time, and I would hate to say more than, I'd hate to say more than a minimal statement. I'm going to show you a document in a minute that does a lot more than that. All right, let's go on. What particular condition is in view here? Incurable or irreversible mental or physical condition with no reasonable expectation of recovery. Okay, what does that mean? How do you measure that? However, on the other hand, you've got to have some sort of parameters. The Quinlan case, as I recall, she was in a coma and fed intravenously for 10 years. And, you know, she was in a vegetative state, and there was no reasonable expectation of recovery. She was in apparently irreversible mental, or both mental and physical condition, and she was just kept going. I I suppose that you always give the benefit of doubt to the side of life, but in a case like that, you just wonder what on earth it amounts to keep somebody alive for that long. I know that I would not want to be kept going for 10 years without any, you know, apparent consciousness or anything. It seems pretty absurd. All right, how about this? I direct my attending physician to withhold or withdraw treatment that merely prolongs my dying. Well, and of course, there are different criteria of death. We've talked about, you know, several, including neocortical death, and I've given you some of my objections to that, though I recognize that there's another point of view. This statement doesn't envisage the type of definition. It just says dying. We've talked about this, but any quarrels with the distinction withholding or withdrawing? I mean, that's a huge issue for the modern state, but we've covered it. With Wenberg, I would tend to think, in most cases, withdrawing is kind of the moral equivalent of withholding, in that you're going back to a decision that you should have made in the first place. At least that's the way he puts it. Now, it's not always that way, but it's in most cases. I further direct that treatment be limited to measures to keep me comfortable and relieve pain. So in other words, they're making a big distinction here. It's one thing to preserve your life, which they don't want, but it's another thing to administer medicine that will relieve pain, which I think is reasonable, although, you know, we're in a culture that is against pain and wants to avoid it at all costs. And there are times when you need to choose between some pain and much cure, and no pain and no cure. But this is not envisaging a situation like that. Of course, in the pending legislation out in Washington State, we're talking about something very different here. We're talking about a doctor-assisted exit. And this is not pain-relieving medicine, although it happens to be the same stuff, but it's not the purpose of it. It's euthanasia. This document reminds everyone, in this third paragraph here, that there is a legal right to refuse treatment, and we in this country respect that under almost every circumstance. I say almost because we don't respect it when it's a suicide attempt, nor do most states allow the children of Jehovah's Witnesses not to have a transfusion and stuff like that. But this expresses legal right to refuse treatment. Therefore, I expect my family doctor and everyone concerned with my care to regard themselves as legally, morally bound to act according with my wishes, and in doing so are free of any legal liability for having followed my directions. Now, you understand that this document is not legally binding. Every state except two, however, has accepted the living will as an indication that is generally meant to guide the hospitals and so forth. So that's saying it's becoming less and less likely that anyone could sue for going against it. Okay, let's skip the next part, because I'm going to show you another document in a minute. But let's go down to the proxy. What do we think of naming someone to see that our wishes are carried out? We have had a couple of cases at Chestnut Hill Hospital where some of the relatives disagreed. And I suppose in that case it would have been helpful for someone to have been designated. I had one case fairly recently where I think that a daughter thought that it was all wrong to let a person just go, and it took her months and months to get reconciled to it. And she finally did get reconciled, and I think one of the reasons she did was because she began to see that it's one thing emotionally to hang on to somebody, it's another thing to force that person to suffer more than they need to at the moment of death. I mean, this was a person who was going to die anyway. And it was a matter of keeping him alive for a few more weeks or something like that. And she finally came around to seeing that you weren't doing him any favors to preserve him for a few more weeks. But it would have helped to have somebody just designated, I guess. And then signing and witnessing.
Isn't this related to whenever we designate someone in our will to be the executor of our estate?
Okay, that's a slightly different thing. That's durable power of attorney, mm-hmm. which there's a distinction because the living will is not as formal, and it also has more loose ends to it. A durable power of attorney actually enables legally someone to make the medical decisions for you. Living will is basically the wish. Even though it's called a will, it's basically it's wishing. Let me give you the next thing. This makes the distinction between durable power of attorney and living will. This is from our hospital. They have a whole pamphlet. I'll try and get you the pamphlet at some point. I should have gone down and gotten some. This is from our little pamphlet. Your wishes. Yeah.
Right.
But okay, that's right. The only thing is, the living will just doesn't have the binding power, you know, although it is coming to that. Here's the distinction. Durable power of attorney has a written statement appointing another person to act on your behalf if you're deemed incompetent or unable to make decisions. It is a legal document. The person holding power of attorney should know you well. In order to represent your best interests, you should discuss treatment preferences, including types of treatment that you do not desire. Durable power of attorney allows your agent to make health care decisions, including consent for treatments and procedures, and gives that person access to information about your medical condition. Even after a power of attorney document is signed, you have a right to continue to make health care decisions as long as you are able. No treatment may be given or stopped if you object. That's quite true. You also have a right to revoke the authority anytime by just notifying the agent. Durable power of attorney is a legal arrangement. If you're interested in this kind of arrangement, please consult your legal advisor. I had one of these for my mother. The nursing home where she was made the family have a durable power of attorney as a condition of her going in there. You know, and they know from experience that that's what you need, because a person can go into a state where they're not responsible, and somebody's got to be responsible. Now, the living will is a less formal way of stating your wishes. While living wills are not recognized legally in Pennsylvania, that's one of the two states, they do act as a guide for those who may need to make medical decisions on your behalf. A living will enables you to specify what kinds of care you want and don't want. And then they say they both serve as a means to express your wishes. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons that Pennsylvania has been hesitating about it, I think it's just been pretty well cleared up, and that is the pro-life people have pointed out that you could misuse the living will as a dying pregnant woman to kill a fetus unnecessarily. And so they've gotten around that by making some legislation that goes for the preserving of the fetus if possible, even if you're going to let the woman go because of her wishes and so on. So that's one of the obstacles, and it's recently, I think, being surmounted. One of the most difficult aspects of this, but I think as Christians it's a good thing, is having the conversation with the person about your wishes. I know my father sat me down and said, listen, son, in the event that I should get into a place where I have no control, I want you to tell him, don't keep me alive. And I think that was hard for him to do. It was certainly hard for me to listen to that, you know, because it's my father. But it was good. We both faced the obvious that he was going to die. Well, we all are. And then we were able to get it out and over with, and then it was done, you know. But that's a hard thing. I know that going to somebody you trust and love and explaining that when you die, this is how you want to be treated, is just a tough thing, you know. But I think it's important. Got to get a lawyer. It's a very simple piece of paper. I think it's only a one-sided piece of paper. It says there's an opening paragraph that says I authorize X to be my representative in all medical decisions. Something. It's a little more technical than that, but that's about it. And then you have to notarize it and sign it, and that's it. That's all there is to it. Any lawyer, I think probably notaries have these things. Well, it involves a notarization. We got ours from a lawyer simply because he had the documents. I don't think they're the only people who have it. But it is a legal. It is a legal document. You know, it's a contract. It's not a suggestion. It's legally binding. If you make a medical decision that's within the law on behalf of your relative, it is required. You know, so. All right. Now I want to look at this. Here, because the living will states what you want done. The durable power of attorney gives the decision to somebody else. And he may or may not want what you want done. He should. You wouldn't give it to somebody who doesn't, but that could happen. Look, I just found one. Why don't I give you this thing first? Here's a durable power of attorney.
I thought I'd brought one along.
Here it is. I understand that my wishes expressed in these four cases may not cover all possible. Oh yeah. All right. Let me give you the rest of it because this is a
part of a package here.
Let me show you what this is, and then we'll talk about it. This is one response to the right to self-determination, which the government is mandating that every healthcare institution make clear to the patients. Now, I say this is one response because there's some controversial aspects to it. But this is a one medical directive form where your desires can be enumerated. And if you look at these four situations, A, B, C, and D, you'll find all these options. Situation A, if I'm in a coma or a persistent vegetative state, and in the opinion of my physician and several consultants, have no known hope of regaining awareness and higher mental functions, no matter what is done, then my wishes regarding use of the following, if considered medically reasonable, would be. All right, then it says, the printing didn't work very well. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, mechanical breathing, artificial nutrition, kidney dialysis, minor surgery, blood products, antibiotics, and so on. You've got all these options. Okay? And then it says, I want treatment if no clear improvement stop. I am undecided. I do not want. Okay? And they have this for all these categories. Here's the second situation. If I'm in a coma, in the opinion of my physician and several consultants, have a small likelihood of recovering, a slightly larger likelihood of surviving with permanent brain damage, and a much larger likelihood of dying, then my wishes regarding the following blah, blah, blah. Or situation C, if I have brain damage or some brain disease that, in opinion of my physicians, cannot be reversed, makes me unable to recognize people or to speak understandably, and I also have a terminal illness, such as incurable cancer, that will likely be the cause of my death, then my wishes are. Or situation D, if I have brain damage or some brain disease that, in the opinion of my physician and several consultants, cannot be reversed, makes me unable to recognize people and speak, but I have no terminal illness, then here's what I want. Okay? Those are all the options. And then they have a durable power of attorney. I understand that my wishes to express in these four cases may not cover all possible aspects of my care if I become incompetent. I also may be undecided about whether I want particular treatment or not. Consequently, there may be a need for someone to accept or refuse medical intervention for me in case, in consultation with my physician. I authorize, you know, John Doe as my proxy. And then it says, should there be any disagreement between the wishes I've indicated in this document and the decision favored by the above name, A, I wish my proxy to have authority, B, I wish my medical directive to have authority over my proxy. And then they have another thing about organ donation. Now, this is one answer to the self-determination directives. This is one group, I think it's a hospital in New England somewhere, that has responded. There's been a lot of discussion about this, because there are two sides to the story. One side is that the patient has rights of self-determination, and therefore needs to be informed about all the scenarios that can develop, and needs to make a perhaps rather different type of decision for each particular scene. The other side, and there's a fair amount of criticism that's coming in, and I guess I would share that criticism, is that this is a lot to ask of a patient. It's a lot to ask of somebody to predict certain variants, you know, dialysis in the case of brain damage, but that has no permanent disease attached to it. You know, well, goodness, how do I know? And it's such a reaction to the 60s or 50s and 60s where the doctor did everything, that now the doctor needs to do almost nothing. There was a very interesting article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, affectionately known as JAMA, by a Dr. Alan Brett, August 14th, 1991, quite recently. Title of it is Limitations of Listing Specific Medical Interventions in Advanced Directives. And the summary of the article is simply this. Recent events, including the Cruzan decision and the passage of the Patient Self-Determination Act, have renewed interest in the strengths and limitations of various types of advanced directives. In one well-known approach, and that's this one I've just shown you, the competent person indicates preferences for or against a series of medical interventions that might be considered if the person loses decision-making capacity. However, such lists of interventions may shift attention away from overall treatment goals or may prescribe inappropriate medical care. Moreover, listing specific interventions in advance does not necessarily enhance self-determination or reduce uncertainty in decision-making. And there's a lot of documentation here. And I found the article quite convincing. The overall health care is not well represented in these self-determination things, because there are all kinds of goals that involve looking at the entire human being and not just these very, very narrow little decisions. And second of all, it is possible for the patient to have no idea what's appropriate under a certain circumstance and to prescribe for himself the wrong thing. Plus the fact that medical advances are changing the nature of the game almost every week, and what you decide today might become obsolete in a year, and it requires you to keep up with all the information. And that's just a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask of well-educated people, let alone of people who, you know, don't have any awareness of all this stuff. And then his I thought the point that he made most forcefully was that, in fact, listing these limitations, listing specific interventions in advance, does not necessarily give you self-determination, nor does it reduce uncertainty in decision-making. You're not determining what your outcome is by making a decision that you have no competence to make. You're simply adding confusion to the story. The long and short of it is that there's got to be some kind of balance. Here's what this man concludes in this JAMA article. He says, the simplest and most practical solution to the problem of advanced directives is to encourage wider use of healthcare proxy directives, which designate a specific person as the surrogate decision maker in the event of a medical incapacity. This approach is not entirely without problems, but an overriding virtue of the proxy concept is its formal acknowledgement of the generally accepted way we already make decisions for the incapacitated patient by enlisting the guidance of the patient's family or other close associates. Nevertheless, some persons may wish to execute a set of written instructions about their medical care, regardless of whether they also formally name a proxy to implement those instructions. For such persons and their physicians, selected features of the newer documents may be useful for clarifying the person's perspective. One such innovation, exemplified in the medical directive, is the use of hypothetical scenarios, and so forth. Discussions of hypothetical cases can facilitate an understanding of relevant distinctions between dementia, coma, persistent vegetative state, and may help interested patients to sharpen previously ill-defined views about life-sustaining measures. Another innovation, exemplified in the values history documents, is to focus on those individual values that might be relevant to decisions about life-sustaining treatment. One of those documents, for example, explicitly asks how the person would view a trade-off between length and quality of life. Another asks whether the person would prefer to limit the amount of money spent on his or her care if doing so would benefit his family. In the final analysis, the most important element in planning for mental incapacity is the quality of communication among patients, families, and healthcare providers. In some cases, a well-crafted instructional advanced directive may be useful as an instrument to facilitate such communication. But whatever the instrument, its main objective should be to clarify the patient's perspective about life, death, medical care. That objective can be achieved without the encumbrances of a list of specific interventions. When we come back from the break, I want to discuss this, and I also want to add a little section from John Frame's book where he recommends the same thing as Brett, and that is the durable power of attorney more than the living will, and we'll show why, and then we'll discuss it. In his book Medical Ethics, starting on page 70 or so, he talks about the living will, and he says that a living will is a legal document wherein someone stipulates that extraordinary means may not be used to keep him alive. As we point out, it's not necessarily a legal document, and it hasn't been for a long time, though it can be treated as such, and according to recent legislation. And the purpose of it is to avoid unduly prolonging the dying process. And he says the the desire for this is legitimate. Yeah, it is kind of cold in here, isn't it? Are those things turning out heat or cold?
It's almost like air.
Mildly warm.
And so his first point is that it's a laudable or legitimate goal to shorten the process of dying. And he repeats one of his earlier remarks that once dying actually begins, you should be allowed to die. And he argues that not to allow someone to die is to place an undue burden on that person. That in effect is a breach of the golden rule. But he has a number of reservations about the living will, some of which I share, some of which I don't think I do share particularly. So the first one is that the distinction between ordinary and extraordinary care is not precise. Now, the living will that we looked at here, it says, I being of sound mind make the statement, if I become unable to participate, if I should be an incurable or irreversible mental or physical condition with no reasonable expectation of recovery, here's what I direct. And then it says, these directions express my legal right to refuse treatment. Therefore, I expect my family to comply. Nothing here is mentioned about extraordinary and ordinary care. I think in the older living wills, they probably did this. In the newer living wills, you don't use that terminology for the reason that he quite rightly points out. The directive is much more precise. If it's incurable or irreversible, here's what I want done. Now, the second thing he points out is hope of recovery is imprecise, and that, of course, is true. Does it mean restoration of consciousness or of a certain quality of life? All right, is that a good reservation? Is that something that should make one reserved about the living will? This particular living will doesn't go into quality of life, especially. Frame says, if we make the document too precise, we may remove from the physician exactly the flexibility he needs to respond adequately. That's Dr. Alan Brett's objection to that medical directive that we read with all those scenarios. I personally don't consider this an objection. I consider it perhaps a necessary area of fuzziness, you know, but you're going to make this decision no matter what. Somebody's got to decide on the basis of hope of recovery. They're going to have to decide something. No reasonable expectation of recovery, I think, is about the best we can do in a lot of scenarios. I mean, doctors are always deciding, if you go in for appendicitis, you know, it's reasonable to expect you're going to recover, but they can't guarantee that you're going to make it, you know.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's right. Of course, the living will, if you can find the right language, it should include that possibility. Because all of a sudden, no reasonable expectation of recovery could, you know, it could be reasonable to think that a new cure would do something. Chances might be against it, but it's still reasonable to use such a thing. You know, if you find the right language, you can probably get around that problem. All right, his third disclaimer here is, a person's intentions may be different from his desires in the actual crisis. That's true as long as the person is awake. And
yeah.
Yeah. How are you going to...
desires.
Yeah, it has desires, you know. So, he cites a case here where a patient wakes up and says, wait, don't let me die. Well, not, if they do, then you don't let them die. I mean, it's pretty hypothetical. You sometimes get the impression that these people haven't been around hospitals much. And then finally, the living will, vague as its language often is, may create legal snarls, demands for court rulings, and so forth. And I would say yes, but so does buying a house, or, of course, this is not the same order of importance, but...